quiet voice. Maybe the girl had woken up from a nightmare too, Anna thought. Or maybe she hadn't. Chapter 13. Bull. Arriving at the ring was a political fiction, but that didn't keep it from being real. There was no physical boundary to say that this was within the realm of the object. There was no port to dock at. The behemoth sensory arrays had been sucking in data from the ring since before they'd left Tycho. The Martian science ships and Earth military forces that had been there before the doomed Belter kid had become its first casualty were still there, where they had been, but resupplied now. The new Martian ships had joined them, matched orbit, and were hanging quietly in the sky. The Earth flotilla, like the behemoth, was in the last part of the burn, pulling up to whatever range they'd chosen to stop at, to say, "We have come across the vast abyss to float at this distance, and now we are here. We've arrived." As far as anyone could tell, the ring didn't give a damn. The structure itself was eerie. The surface was a series of twisting ridges that spiraled around its body. At first they appeared uneven, almost messy. The mathematicians, architects, and physicists assured them all that there was a deep regularity there, the height of the ridges in a complex harmony with the width and the spacing between the peaks and valleys. The reports were breathless, finding one layer of complexity after another, the intimations of intention and design all laid bare without any hint of what it all might mean. "The official Martian reports have been very conservative," the science officer said. His name was Chan Baoji, and on Earth, he'd have been Chinese. Here, he was a Belter from Palace Station. "They've given a lot of summary and maybe a tenth of the data they've collected. Fortunately, we've been able to observe most of their experiments and make our own analysis." "Which Earth will have been doing too," Ashford said. "Without doubt, sir," Chan said. Like any ritual, the staff meeting carried more significance than information. The heads of all the major branches of the behemoth structural tree were present: Sam for engineering, Bull for security, Chan for the research teams, Benny Cortland Mapu for health services, Anna Marie Ruiz for infrastructure, and so on, filling the 24 seats around the great conference table. Ashford sat in the place of honor, another beneficent Christ painted on the wall behind him. Pa sat at his right hand, and Bull, by tradition, at his left. "What have we got?" Ashford said. "Short form." "It's fucking weird, sir," Chan said, and everyone chuckled. "Our best analysis is that the ring is an artificially sustained Einstein-Rosen bridge. You go through the ring, you don't come out the other side here."
"So, it's a gate," Ashford said.
"Yes, sir. It appears that the protomolecule, or Phoebe bug, or whatever you want to call it, was launched at the solar system several billion years ago, aiming for Earth with the intention of hijacking primitive life to build a gateway. We're positing that whoever created the protomolecule did it as a first step toward making travel to the solar system more convenient and practical later." Bull took a deep breath and let it out slowly. It was what everyone had been thinking, but hearing it spoken in this official setting made it seem more real. The ring was a way for something to get here, not just a gateway, a beachhead. When the EK went through it, the mass and velocity of the ship triggered some mechanism in the ring, Chan said. "The Martians have a good data set from the moment it happened, and there was a massive outpouring of energy within the ring structure and a whole cascade of micro-level conformation changes. The entire object went up to about 5,000 degrees Kelvin, and it has been cooling regularly ever since.
So, it took a lot of effort to get that thing running, but it looks like not much to maintain. What do we know about what's on the other side? Pa asked. Her expression was neutral, her voice pleasant and unemotional. She could have been asking him to justify a line item in his budget. It's hard to know much, Chan said. We're peeking through a keyhole, and the ring itself seems to be generating interference and radiation that makes getting consistent readings difficult. We know the EK wasn't destroyed. We're still getting the video feed that the kid was spewing when he went through. It's just not showing as much.
Stars? Ashford said. Something we can start to navigate from?
No, sir, Chan said. The far side of the ring doesn't have any stars, and the background microwave radiation is significantly different from what we'd expect.
Meaning what? Ashford said.
Meaning, that's weird, Chan said.
Sir?
Ashford's smile was cool as he motioned the science officer to continue. Chan coughed before he went on. We have a couple of other anomalies that we aren't quite sure what to make of. It looks like there's a maximum speed on the other side.
Can you unpack that, please? Pa said.
The EK went through the ring going very fast, Chan said. About 7/10 of a second after it reached the other side, it started a massive deceleration, bled off almost all its speed in about 5 seconds. It looks like the nearly instant deceleration was what killed the pilot. Since then, it seems as if the ship is being moved out away from the ring and deeper into whatever's on the other side. We know that when the protomolecule's active, it's been able to alter what we'd expect from inertia, Sam said. Is that how it stopped the ship?
That's entirely possible, Chan said.
Mars has been pitching probes through the ring, and it looks like we start seeing the effect right around 600 meters per second. Under that, mass behaves just the way we expect it to. Over that, it stops dead and then moves off in approximately the same direction that the EK is going. Sam whistled under her breath. That's really slow, she said. The main drives would be almost useless.
It's slower than a rifle shot, Chan said.
The good news is it only affects mass above the quantum level. The electromagnetic spectrum seems to behave normally, including visible light.
Thank God for small favors, Sam said.
What else are the probes telling us?
There's something out there, Chan said.
And for the first time, a sense of dread leaked into his voice. The probes are seeing objects, large ones. But there's not much light except what we're shining through the ring or mounting on the probes. And as I said, the ring has always given inconsistent returns. If whatever's there is made of the same stuff, who knows?
Ships? Ashford said.
Maybe.
How many?
Over 100? Under 100,000, probably. Bull leaned forward, his elbows on the table. Ashford and Pa were looking around the table at the graying faces. They'd known before, because they weren't going to wait for a staff meeting to get their information. Now they were judging the reactions. So he'd given them a reaction. Control the fall.
Be weirder if there wasn't anything there. If it was an attack fleet, they'd have attacked by now.
Yeah, Ruiz said, latching onto the words. Ashford opened the floor to questions. How many probes had Mars fired through? How long would it take something going at 600 meters per second to reach one of the structures? Had they tried sending small probes in? Had there been any contact from the protomolecule itself, the stolen voices of humans, the way there had been with Eros? Chan did his best to be reassuring without actually having anything more that he could say. Bull assumed there was a deeper report that Ashford and Pa were getting, and he wondered what was in it. Being kept out chafed.
All right, this is all interesting, but it's not our focus,
Ashford said, bringing the Q&A session to a halt. We're not here to send probes through the ring. We're not here to start a fight. We're just making sure that whatever the inner planets do, we're at the table. If something comes out of the ring, we'll worry about it then. Yes, sir, Bull said, throwing his own weight behind Ashford's. It wasn't like there was another strategy. Better that the crew see them all unified. People were watching how this all came down, and not just the crew. Mr. Pa, Ashford said. The XO nodded and glanced at Bull. Instinct dropped a weight in his gut. There have been some irregularities in the ship's accounting structure, Pa said. Chief Engineer Rosenberg? Sam nodded, surprise on her face. XO? She said. I'm afraid I'm going to have to restrict you to quarters and revoke your access privileges until this is all clarified. Chief Watanabe will relieve you. Mr. Baka, you'll see to it. The room was just as silent, but the meaning behind it was different now. Sam's eyes were wide with disbelief and rising fury. Excuse me? She said. Pa met her gaze coolly, and Bull understood all of it in an instant. Records show you've been drawing resources from work and materials budgets that weren't appropriate, Pa said. And until the matter is resolved...
If this is about the tech support thing, that's on me, Bull said. I authorized that. It's got nothing to do with Sam.
I'm conducting a full audit, Mr. Barker. If I find you've been drawing resources inappropriately, I'll take the actions I deem appropriate. As your executive officer, I'm informing you that Samara Rosenberg is to be confined to quarters and her access to ship systems blocked. Do you have any questions about that? She'd waited until they'd made the trip, until they'd gotten where they were going, and now it was time to establish that she was in control. To get back at him for the drug dealer he'd spaced, and punish Sam for being his ally. Would have been stupid to do until their shakedown run was over, but now it was. Bull laced his fingers together. The refusal was on the back of his tongue, waiting. It would have been insubordination, and it would have been easy as breathing out. There were years, decades even, when he'd have done it and taken the consequences as a badge of honor. It had been his call, and standing by while Sam was punished for it was more than dishonorable. It was disloyal. Pa knew that. Anyone who'd read his service records would know it. If it had just been his mission, his career on the line, he'd have done it. But Fred Johnson had asked him to make this work. So there was only one play to make.
No questions, he said, rising from his chair. Sam, you should come with me now.
The others were silent as he led her out of the conference room. They all looked stunned and confused, except Ashford and Pa. Pa wore a poker face, and Ashford had a little shadow of smugness in the corners of his mouth. Sam's breath shook. Outrage and adrenaline left her skin pale. He helped her into the side seat of a security cart, then got behind the controls. They lurched into motion, four small engines whirring and whining. They were almost at the elevators when Sam laughed. A short, mirthless sound, as much like a cry of pain as anything.
Holy shit, Sam said.
Bull couldn't think of anything to say that would pull the punch, so he only nodded and took the cart into the wide elevator car. Sam wept, but there was nothing that looked like sorrow in her expression. He guessed that she'd never suffered that kind of disciplinary humiliation before. Or if she had, it hadn't been often enough to build up a callus. The dishonor of letting her take the hit was like he'd swallowed something before he'd chewed it enough, and now it wouldn't go down. Back at the security office, Serge was at the main desk. The man's eyebrows rose as Bull came into the room. Hoi, Bossman, the duty officer said. A hardcore OPA bruiser named Jojo. Que pasa?
Nothing good. What did I miss?
Complaint from a carniceria down by engineering about a missing goat. Got a note from one of the Earth ships, lost one of their crew, wondering if we'd come up with an extra. A couple Koyos got shit-faced and we locked him in quarters. Told him we'd sick the bull on him.
How'd they take that?
We had them mop up after. Bull chuckled before he sighed.
So, I've got Samara Rosenberg in the cart outside, he said. XO wants her confined to quarters for unauthorized use of resources.
I want a pony in a wetsuit, Jojo grinned.
XO gave an order, Bull said. I want you to take her to her quarters. I'll get her access pulled. We'll need to set a guard while we're at it. She's pissed.
Jojo scratched his neck.
We're doing it?
Yeah. Jojo's face closed. Bull nodded toward the door. Jojo left and Bull took his place at the desk, identifying himself to the system and starting the process of locking Sam out of her own ship. While the security system ran its check against each of the behemoth subsystems, he leaned on his elbows and watched. The first time Fred Johnson saved Bull's life, he'd done it with a rifle and a mobile medical unit. The second time, he'd done it with a credit chip. Bull had mustered out at 30 and took his pension to Ceres. For 3 years, he'd just lived, ate cheap, drank too much, slept in his own bed not knowing if he was sick from the alcohol or the spin, not caring much. He got into a few fights, had a few disagreements with the local law. He didn't see that he had a problem until it was unmistakable, and by then it was a hell of a problem. Depression ran in his family. Self-medicating did too. His grandfather had died of the pear. His mother had been in therapy a couple times. His brother had graduated to heroin and lived 5 years in a treatment center in Roswell. None of it had seemed to have anything to do with Bull. He was a Marine. He'd turned away from a life on basic to live in the stars, or, if not the stars, at least the rocks that floated free in the night sky. He'd killed men. Bottle couldn't beat him, but it almost had. The day Fred Johnson had appeared at his door, it had been stranger than a dream. His former commanding officer looked different, older, stronger. Truth was, their birthdays weren't all that far apart, but Johnson had always been the old man. Bull had followed the news about the fallout from Anderson Station and Fred's changing sides. Some of the other Marines he knew on Ceres had been angry about it. He'd just figured the old man knew what he was doing. He wouldn't have done it without a reason. Bull, Fred had said. Just that at first. He could still remember Fred's dark eyes meeting his. The shame had made Bull try to stand straighter, to suck in his gut a little. In that moment, he saw how far he'd fallen. 2 seconds of seeing himself through Fred Johnson's eyes was all it took for that.
Sir, Bull had replied,
then stood back and let Johnson into the hole. The place stank of yeast and old tofu and flop sweat. Fred ignored it all.
I need you back on duty, soldier.
Okay, Bull had said. And the secret he carried with him, the one he'd take to his grave, was this. He hadn't meant it. In that moment, all he'd wanted was for Fred Johnson to go away and let Bull forget him again. Lying to his old commanding officer, to the man who'd kept him from bleeding out under fire, came as naturally as breathing. It didn't have anything to do with Earth, or the Belt, or Anderson Station. It wasn't some greater loyalty. He just wasn't done destroying himself. And even now, sitting alone at the security desk, betraying Sam, He thought that Fred had known, or guessed. Fred had pressed a credit chip into his palm. It was one of the cheap, vaguely opalescent ones that the OPA had used to keep its funds untraceable back in the bad old days.
Get yourself a new uniform.
Bull had saluted, already thinking about the booze he could buy. The chit carried 6 months' wages at his old pay grade. If it had been less, Bull wouldn't have gone. Instead, he shaved for the first time in days, got a new suit, packed a valise, and threw out anything that didn't fit in it. He hadn't had a drink since, even on the nights he wanted one more than oxygen. The security system chimed that the lockout was finished. Bull noted it and leaned back in the chair, reading the Be On Alert notice from the Cerisier and letting his mind wander. When Gathoni arrived to take the next shift, he walked two corridors down to a little mom-and-pop bodega, bought a blister pack with 4 bulbs of beer, and headed over to Sam's quarters. The guard on duty nodded to him. Legally, Bull didn't have to knock. As head of security, he could have walked into Sam's rooms at any time with or without being welcome. He knocked. Sam was wearing a simple sweater and black work pants with magnetic stripes down the sides. Bull held up the beer. For a long moment, Sam glared at him. She stepped back and to the side. He followed her in. Her rooms were clean, neat, and cluttered. The air smelled like industrial lubricant and old laundry. She leaned against the arm of a foam couch. "Peace offering?" she said bitterly.
"Pretty much," Bull said. "Pa's pissed off at me, and she's taking it out on you. She figured either I do it and lose my best ally, or I don't, and I'm the one confined to quarters, right? No way to lose for her."
"This is bullshit."
"It is," Bull said. "And I'm sorry as hell about the whole damn thing."
Sam's breath rattled with anger. Bull accepted it. He had it coming. She walked across to him, grabbing the 4-pack out of his hand, twisting it to shatter the plastic, and plucking one of the bulbs free.
"You want one?"
she asked.
"Just water for me," he said.
"What chafes me," Sam said, "is the way Ashford just sits there like he's so happy about the whole thing. He knows the score. He's as much a part of it as Pa. Or you. Don't think you can buy me off with a few cheap brews. You're just as much at fault as they are."
"I am.
I got into engineering because I didn't want all the petty social bird shit. And now look at me."
"Yeah," Bull said.
Sam dropped to the couch with a sigh and said something obscene and colorful. Bull sat down across from her. "Okay, stop that," she said.
"What?"
"That looking repentant thing. I feel like I'm supposed to genuflect or something. It's creepy." She took a long pull at the bulb, the soft plastic collapsing under the suction, then expanding out a little as the beer outgassed.
"Look, you and Pa are both doing what you think you ought to, and I'm getting screwed. I get it. Doesn't mean I have to be happy about it. Thing is, you're right. She wants you to lose allies. So, no matter how much I want to tell you to go put your dick in a vice, I'm not going to. Just because it would mean Pa won."
"Thank you for that, Sam." "Go put your dick in a vice, Bull." Bull's hand terminal chimed.
"Mr. Baca," Gathoni's voice said. "You should come back to the office, maybe."
Sam's expression sobered, and she put down the bulb. Bull's belly tightened.
"What's going on?" he asked.
When Gathoni answered, her voice was controlled and calm as a medic calling for more pressure.
"Earth destroyer Sung-un?
It just blew up." Chapter 14. Melba. When she'd thought about it,
planning the final closing stages of her vengeance. She pictured herself as the conductor of a private symphony, moving her baton to the orchestrated chaos. It didn't happen that way at all. The morning she went to the Thomas Prince, she didn't know that the day had finally come. "Active hands to stations," a man's voice announced over the general channel. "Wish to fuck they'd stop doing that," Melba said. "Always makes me feel like I should be doing something."
"Savvy, boss. When they start paying me Navy wages, I'll start jumping for their drills," Soledad said, her voice pressed thin by the hand terminal speaker.
"I've got nothing on this couple. Unless Stani's got it, we got to move down a level. Try again."
"Copy that," Melba said.
"Stani, what are you seeing?"
The channel went silent. Melba looked around the service corridor at a half kilometer of nothing. Conduit and pipes and the access grating that could shift to accommodate any direction of thrust. The only sounds were the creaking, hissing, and muttering of the Thomas Prince. The seconds stretched.
"Stani," Soledad said, dread in her voice, and the channel crackled.
"Pardon," Stani said. "Looking at some weird wiring. But it's not the goose we're hunting. Lost in my head, me. I'm fine. I'm here."
Soledad said something obscene under her breath.
"Sorry," Stani said again.
"It's okay," Melba said. "Did you check the brownout buffers?"
"Did."
"Then let's just keep moving. Next level."
The thing that surprised her, the one she hadn't seen coming, was how everyone on the Cerisier was ready to put Ren's disappearance at the foot of the ring. It was rare for people to go missing on a ship. The Cerisier, like any other long-haul vessel, was a closed system. There was nowhere to go. She'd assumed there would be the usual human suspicions. Ren had crossed someone, stolen something, slept with the wrong person, and he'd been disposed of. Thrown out an airlock, maybe. Fed into the recycling and reduced to his basic nutrients, then passed into the water or food supply. It wasn't that there were no ways to hide or dispose of a body. It was that there were so few ways for it to go unnoticed. Traveling between the planets had never eliminated murder. So many highly evolved primates in the same box for months on end, a certain death rate had to be expected. This time, though, it was different. It made sense to people that someone would go missing, vanish as they approached the ring. It felt right. The voyage itself was ill-omened, and strange things were supposed to happen when people drew too near the uncanny, the dangerous, the haunted. The others were all on edge, and that gave her cover, too. If she'd started weeping, they'd think they understood why. They'd think it was fear. Melba packed her diagnostic array back in its sleeve, stood, and headed down to the lift. The internal service lifts were tiny, with hardly enough room for one person and the gear. Traveling between decks here was like stepping into a coffin. As she shifted down to the next level, she imagined the power failing, being trapped there. Her mind flickered, and for a moment she saw her own storage locker, the one in her quarters, the one filled with sealant foam, and Ren. She shuddered and forced her mind elsewhere. The Thomas Prince was one of the larger ships in the Earth flotilla, the home of the civilian horde that the UN had put together. Artists, poets, philosophers, priests. Even without changing the physical structures of the ship, it gave her the feeling of being less a military vessel and more a poorly appointed, uncomfortable cruise liner. Clarissa had been on yachts and luxury ships most of the times she'd traveled outside Earth's gravity well, and she could imagine the thousand complaints the ship's captain would suffer about the hulls not being wide enough and the screens on the walls too low a quality. It was the sort of thing she would have been concerned with in her previous life. Now, it was less than nothing.
It shouldn't have bothered her. One more death, more or less. It shouldn't have mattered. But it was Ren.
In position, Stani said.
Give me a second, Melba said, stepping out of the lift. The new corridor was nearly identical to the one above it. The decks were all quarters and storage, with very little of the variation that she'd see when they reached the lowest levels, engineering, machine shops, hangar bays. Tracking down the electrical anomaly, they'd started here because it was easy. The longer it took, the harder it would get. Like everything. She found the junction, took the diagnostic array out of its sleeve and plugged it in.
Sole?
In place, Soledad said.
Okay, Melba said. Start the trace.
When it had happened, she'd gotten Ren to her quarters and laid him out on the floor. She'd already felt the crash coming on, so she'd lain down on her bunk and let it come. It might only have been her imagination that made that one seem worse than the ones before. For a long, horrified moment at the end, she thought that she'd voided herself. But her uniform was clean. She'd gone then, Ren still on her floor, gotten a bulb of coffee, put Ren's hand terminal in a stall of the group head, and found the security officer. He was a thin Martian named Andre Komeni, and he'd listened to her informal report with half an ear. Ren had called her and asked her to consult with him. When she'd gone to see him at his usual workstation, he wasn't there. She'd been through the ship, but she hadn't found him, and he wasn't answering connection requests. She was starting to get concerned. While they'd done a sweep of the ship, she'd gotten the tubes of sealant foam, gone back to her quarters, and entombed him. His hair had seemed brighter, the orange like something from a coral reef. His skin was pale as sunlight where the blood had drained away from it, purple as a bruise where it had pooled. Rigor hadn't set in, so she was able to fold him together, curled like a fetus, and fill the spaces around him with foam. It had taken minutes to harden. The foam was engineered to be airtight and pressure-resistant. If she'd done it right, the corpse smell would never leak out.
Nadie, Soledad said, sounding resigned.
You guys got anything?
Hey, Stani said.
Think I do. I got a 10% fluctuation on this box.
Okay, Melba said. Let's reset it and see if that clears the issue.
On it, Stani said.
Grab some lunch while it run.
I'll meet you in the galley, Melba said.
Her voice seemed almost normal. She sounded like someone else. The galley was nearly empty. By the ship's clock, it was the middle of the night, and only a few officers lurked at their tables, watching the civilians as they passed. The terms of the service contract meant they got to use the officers' mess. She'd heard there was a certain level of distrust among the Navy crews for civilians like her and her team. She would have resented it more if she hadn't been the living example of why their suspicions were justified.
Soledad and Stani were already at a table, drinking coffee from bulbs and sharing a plate of sweet rolls.
I'm going to miss these when we cut thrust, Stani said, holding one of the rolls up.
Best cook flying can't beak right without thrust.
How long you think we're going to be on the float?
As long as it takes, Melba said.
They're planning for 2 months.
2 months at Null G, Soledad said. But her voice and the grayness of her face were clear.
2 months at the ring.
Yeah, Stani said. Any word on Bob?
The fifth of the team, fourth now, was still back on the Cerisier. It turned out he and Ren had both been having a relationship with a man on the medical team, and security were rounding up the usual suspects. Most times someone went missing, it was domestic. Melba felt her throat going thick again.
Nothing yet, she said. They'll clear him. He wouldn't have done anything.
Yeah, Soledad said.
Bob wouldn't hurt anyone. He's a good man. Everyone knew about everything, and he loved Ren.
Could stop the passato, Stani said. We don't know he's dead.
With ese cosa out there, dead's the best thing he could be, Soledad said. I've been having bad dreams since we flipped. I don't think we're making it back from this run. Not any of us.
Talking like that won't help, Stani said.
A woman walked into the galley. Middle-aged, thick red hair pulled into a severe-looking bun that competed with her smile. Melba looked at her to try not to be at the table, then looked away.
Whatever happened to Ren, she said, we've got our job to do, and we'll do it.
Damn right, Stani said, and then again with a catch in his voice.
Damn right.
They sat together quietly for a moment while the older man wept. Sole put a hand on his arm, and Stani's shuddering breath slowed. He nodded, swallowed. He looked like an icon of grief and courage. He looked noble. It struck Melba for the first time that Stani was probably her father's age, and she had never seen her father weep for anyone.
I'm sorry, she said. She hadn't planned to speak the words, but there they were, coughed up on the table. They seemed obscene.
It's okay, Stani said. I'm all right. Here, boss, have a roll.
Melba reached out, fighting herself not to weep again, not to speak. She didn't know what she'd say, and she was afraid of herself. The alert chimed on her hand terminal. The diagnostic was finished. It only took a second to see that the spike was still there. Stani said something profane, then shrugged.
No rest for the wicked, no peace for the good, he said, standing.
Go ahead, Melba said. I'll catch up.
Pa problema, Soledad said. You hardly got to drink your coffee, Sessa.
She watched them go, relieved that they wouldn't be there and wanting to call them back both at the same time. The thickness in her throat had traveled to her chest. The sweet rolls looked delicious and nauseating. She forced herself to take a few deep breaths. It was almost over. The fleets were there. The Rocinante was there. Everything was going according to her plan, or, if not quite that, at least near enough to it. Ren shouldn't have mattered. She'd killed men before him. It was almost inevitable that people would die when the bomb went off. Vengeance called forth blood, because it always did. That was its nature, and she had made herself its instrument. Ren wasn't her fault. He was Holden's. Holden had killed him by making her presence necessary. If he had respected the honor of her family, none of this would have happened. She stood up, squared herself, prepared to get back to the job of fixing the Thomas Prince, just the way the real Melba would have.
I'm sorry, Ren, she said, thinking it would be the last time, and the sorrow that shook her made her sit back down.
Something was wrong. This wasn't how it was supposed to be. Her control was slipping. She wondered if, after all she'd done, she simply wasn't strong enough. Or if there was something else. Maybe the artificial glands had begun to leak their toxins into her bloodstream without being summoned. She was getting more emotionally labile. It could be a symptom. She rested her head on her arms and tried to catch her breath. He'd been kind to her. He'd been nothing but kind. He'd helped her, and she'd killed him for it. She could still feel his skull giving way under her hand, crisp and soft, like standing at the bank of a river and feeling the ground fall away. Her fingers smelled like sealant foam. Ren touched her shoulder, and her head snapped up.
Hi, someone said. I'm Anna. What's your name?
It was the redhead who'd been talking to the naval officer a moment ago. I saw you sitting here, she said, sitting down. It looked like you could use some company. It's okay to be afraid. I understand. She knows. The thought ran through Melba's body like a sheet of lightning. Even without her tongue touching her palate, she felt the glands and bladders hidden in her flesh engorging. Her face and hands felt cold. Before the woman's eyes could widen, Melba's sorrow and guilt turned to a cold rage. She knew, and she would expose everything. And then, all of it would have been wasted. She didn't remember rising to her feet, but she was there now. The woman stood and took a step back. I have to kill her. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you. The woman's hands were half raised, as if that were enough to ward off a blow. It would be simple. She didn't look strong. She didn't know how to fight. Kick her in the gut until she bled out. Nothing simpler. A small voice in the back of Melba's mind said, she's one of those idiot priests looking for someone to save. She doesn't know anything. You're in public. If you attack her, they'll catch you. You don't know me, Melba said, struggling to keep her voice calm. You don't know anything. At one of the tables nearest the door, a young officer stood up and took two steps toward them, ready to interfere. If this woman got her thrown in the brig, they'd look into Melba's identity. They'd find Ren's body. They'd find out who she was. She had to keep it together. You're right. I apologize, the woman said. Hatred surged up in Melba's mind, pure and black where it wasn't red. A swamp of obscenities rose in her throat, ready to pour out on the idiot priest who was putting everything, everything in jeopardy. Melba swallowed it all and walked quickly away. The corridors of the Thomas Prince were a vague presence in the unquiet of her mind. She'd let the thing with Ren throw her. It stole her focus and led her into risks she didn't need to take. She hadn't been thinking straight, but now she was. She got into the elevator and selected the level where Stani and Soledad were checking the electrical system, chasing down the failing component. Then she deselected it and picked the hangar. Stani, Sole, she said into her hand terminal. Hold it together for me here. I've got a thing I need to do. She waited for the inevitable questioning, the prying and suspicion. Okay, Soledad said. And that was all. At the hangar, Melba authorized the flight of her shuttle, waited 10 minutes for clearance, and launched out the side of the Thomas Prince and into the black. The shuttle monitors were cheap and small, the vastness of space compressed into 50 centimeters by 50 centimeters. She had the computer figure the fastest burn for the Cerisier. It was less than an hour. She leaned into the thrust like she was riding a roller coaster and let the torch engines burn. The Cerisier appeared in the dusting of stars as a small, gray dot that hurtled toward her. The ship, like all the others in the flotilla, was in the last of the deceleration burn to put them at the ring. Somewhere out past all the glowing drive plumes, it waited. Melba pushed the thought from her mind. It made her think of Stani and Soledad and their quiet fears. She couldn't think of them now. Impatience to arrive made it hard to start the flip and the deceleration burn. She wanted to get there, to be there already. She wanted to speed into the Cerisier like a witch on a broom, screaming in at speeds that wouldn't have been possible in atmosphere. She waited too long and did the last half of the jump at almost 2G. When she docked, she had a headache, and her jaw felt like someone had punched her. No one asked why she was back early, and alone. She listed personal reasons in the log. Walking through the cramped corridors, squeezing past the other crewmen felt oppressive, familiar, and comforting. It took coming back to recognize how much the wider spaces of the Thomas Prince had bothered her. It felt too much like freedom, and she was all about necessity. Her cell was a mess. All of her things, clothes, terminal jack, tampons, communications deck, toothbrush, were scattered on the floor. She'd have to find a way to secure them all before the burn stopped or they'd be floating out into the corridor. People would wonder why they weren't packed away. She let herself glance at the metal door under her crash couch. A tiny golden curl of sealant foam stuck out from one corner. She'd get some kind of mesh bag and some magnets. That would do. It didn't matter. That was later. Nothing later mattered. She picked up the comm deck, turned it on. Ping times to the Rosinante were under 30 seconds. Melba loaded the sequence she'd been waiting to load for months, years. It was a short script. It didn't take a second to prompt her to confirm. The fear was gone. The hatred, too. For a moment, the tiny room was filled with a sense of having just woken from a dream, and her body felt relaxed, almost light. She'd come so far and worked so hard, and despite all of the mistakes and screw-ups and last-minute improvisations, she'd done it. Everything in her life had been aiming toward this moment. And now that she was here, it was almost hard to let it all go. She felt like she was graduating from university or getting married. This moment, this action that fulfilled all the things she'd fought for, and then her world would never be the same. Carefully, savoring each keystroke, she put in the confirmation code. Jules Pierre Mao, and thumbed the send button. The comm deck LED glowed amber. At the speed of light, a tiny packet of information was pulsing out, hardly more than a bit of background static. But the software on the Rosinante would recognize it. The communications array on Holden's ship would be slaved to the virtual machine already installed and impossible to stop without scraping the whole system clean. The Rosinante would send a clearly recognizable trigger code to the Sung-un, wait 53 seconds, and announce Holden's responsibility and his demands. And then the virtual machine would power up the weapons and targeting systems. And nothing, no power in the universe, could stop it from happening. The comm deck got the confirmation response, and the amber LED shifted to red. Chapter 15. Bull. Bull's hand terminal sat on the cart's thin plastic dashboard, jiggling with every bump in the corridor floor. The siren blatted its standard two-tone, scattering people from his path and calling them out behind him. If they didn't know yet, they all would in minutes. The death of the Sung-un wasn't the sort of thing you could overlook. On the small, jittering screen, the destroyer exploded again. At first, it was only a flicker of orange light amidships. Something that could have been electrical discharge or a Gauss gun finishing its maintenance regimen. Half a second later, sparkles of yellow radiated out from the site. 2 seconds after, the major detonation. Between one frame and the next, the destroyer's side bloomed open. Then nothing for full 10 seconds before the fusion reactor core emerged slowly from the back. Brighter than the sun. Bull watched the intense white gases begin to diffuse out and fade into a massive golden aurora, a drop of gold losing cohesion in the oceanic black. He looked up to make the turn onto the ramp that would take him back to the office. A young man ambled slowly out of his path, and Bull leaned on the cart's horn. "There's a siren," Bull yelled as he passed the young man, and got an insolent nod in reply. "Okay," Serge said from the terminal. "We're getting the first security analysis. Best guess, something blew out in one of the power conduits, fused the safety system so they couldn't shut it down. Would have taken about that long to turn the whole starboard main circuit to molten slag."
"What blew?" Bull demanded.
"Probably a maneuvering thruster. About the right place for one. Get it hot enough, water skips steam and just goes straight to plasma. Cuts right through the bulkheads around it."
Bull turned the cart around a tight corner and slowed to let a half dozen pedestrians get out of his way.
"Why'd they dump core?"
"Don't know, but probably they thought they'd lose containment. They got 6 ships diverting now to keep from plowing into that mierda."
"If they'd lost containment, it'd be worse. They'd be diverting to avoid bodies and shrapnel. Are there survivors?"
"Yeah, they're putting out the distress request. Medical and evacuation. Sounds pretty fucked up, Keno."
"What about trace data? Can we tell who shot him?"
"No one shot him. Either it was a straight accident or..."
"Or?"
"Or it wasn't."
Bull bit his lip. An accident would be bad enough. People on all sides of the system's power structure were on edge, and a reminder that Earth's fleet was aging and poorly maintained wouldn't make anything easier. Sabotage would be worse. The closest thing to good news was that everyone had seen it, and there wouldn't be any accusations of enemy action. If there'd been a Gauss round or a lucky missile that had slipped through the Sung-un's defenses undetected, the scientific mission could turn into a shooting war faster than Bull wanted to think about.
"Are we offering assistance?" Bull asked.
"Give us a breath, boss," Serge said. "Ashford ain't hearing any of this faster than us."
Bull leaned forward, his hands wrapping the steering controls until his knuckles went white. Serge was right. What happened outside the ship was Ashford's problem, and Pa's. He was security chief, and he needed to think about what needed doing inside the behemoth. People would be scared, and it was his job to make sure that fear didn't turn into hysteria. Watching a ship blow out, even an enemy ship, reminded everyone how tenuous life was with only a thin skin of steel and ceramic to keep the vacuum at bay. It reminded him. The cart hit a larger bump than usual, and his hand terminal slipped onto its side.
"Okay," Bull said. "Look, we're going to need to get relief supplies ready in case the captain decides to offer assistance. How many survivors can we take on?"
Serge's laughter rasped.
"All of them. With a pinche behemoth. We got enough room for a city, us."
"Okay," Bull said, smiling a little despite himself. It was a stupid question.
"The only thing we got to worry about is..."
The line went dead.
"Serge?"
"Not funny," Bull said. And then,
"Talk to me, mister."
"We got something. Broadcast coming from a private corvette called the Rosinante."
"Why do I know that name?" Bull asked.
"Yeah," Serge said. "I'm putting it to you."
The handset screen blacked out, jumped, and then a familiar face appeared. Bull let the cart slow as James Holden, the man whose announcement about the death of the ice hauler Canterbury started the first war between Earth and Mars, once again made things worse.
"Ship that approaches the ring without my personal permission will be destroyed without warning. Do not test my resolve."
"Oh no," Bull said. "Oh shit, no."
"It has always been a personal mission of mine to assure that information and resources remain free to all people. The efforts of individuals and corporate entities may have helped us to colonize the planets of our solar system and make life possible where it was inconceivable before,
but the danger of someone unscrupulous taking control of the ring is too great. I have proven myself worthy of the trust of the people of the Belt. It is a moral imperative that this shining artifact be protected, and I will spill as much blood as I have to in order to do so. Bull scooped up the hand terminal and tried to connect to Ashford. The red trefoil of command block blinked on the screen and shunted him to a menu that let him record a message for later. He tried PA and got the same thing. Holden's message was looping now, the replayed words just as idiotic and toxic the second time through. Bull said something obscene through clenched teeth. He pulled on the cart, turning the wheels as far as they would go, and stamped on the accelerator. The central lifts were only a minute or two away. He could get there. Just please God let Ashford not do anything stupid before he got to the bridge. "That true, boss," Serge said. "Did Holden just claim us all the ring?" "I want everyone on security mobilized right now," Bull said. "Enemy action protocols. Corridors clear and bulkheads closed. Anyone on a weapons or damage control team, wake them up and get them dressed. You're in charge of that." "You got it, boss," Serge said. "Someone asks, where are you?" "Trying to keep from needing them." "Bien." The familiar corridors seemed longer than usual. The awkwardness of floors built to be walls and walls intended as ceilings, more surreal. If he'd been on a real battleship, there would have been a simple, direct path. If the behemoth's great belly had been spinning, it would have been better than this. He willed the cart faster, pushing the engine past what it could do. The alert klaxon sounded, Serge calling everyone to brace for battle. A crowd had formed at the lift, men and women trying to get back to their stations. Bull pushed through them, the shortest person there, an earther like Holden. At the lift, he activated the security override, called the first car, and stepped in. A tall, dark-skinned man tried to follow him. Bull put a hand on the man's chest, stopping him.
"Take the next one," Bull said. "I'm not going where you want to be."
As the lift rose toward the bridge like it was ascending to heaven, Bull used his hand terminal to grasp for any information. He didn't have access to the secure channels. Only the captain and the XO had those. But there was more than enough public chatter. He ran through the open feeds, grasping for a sense of the situation, watching for a few seconds here, a few seconds there. The Martian science team and their escort were raging at Holden on every feed, calling him a terrorist and a criminal. The Earth flotilla's reaction was quieter. Most of the public conversation was coordinating the rescue efforts on the Sung-Un. The high-energy gas from the core dump was confusing some of the relief crew's comms, and someone fairly smart had started using the public feeds to coordinate them. It had the grim efficiency of a military operation, and it gave Bull hope for the Earth Navy crew still alive on the Sung-Un, as much as it scared him about what was going to come after. Holden's message was repeating, spilling out over the public feeds. At first, it just came from the Rosinante, but soon it was being relayed on other feeds along with commentary. Once the signal got back to the Belt and the inner planets, it was going to be the only thing anyone talked about. Bull could already imagine the negotiations between Earth and Mars, could practically hear them reaching the conclusion that the OPA had gotten too confident and needed to be taken down a notch. Someone on the behemoth put out a copy of Holden's message with a split circle emblem over it and a commentary track saying that it was about time that the Belt take its place and demand the respect it deserved. Bull told Serge to find the feed and shut it down. After what felt like hours, and probably wasn't more than 4 minutes, the lift reached the bridge, the doors opening silently before him, and let Bull out. The bridge wasn't designed for battle. Instead of a real war machine system of multiple stations and controlled lines of command, the Behemoth's bridge was built like the largest tugboat ever made, only with